Hello, and welcome to Anarchy SF, the podcast companion to the Anarchy SF website. My name is Eden, in case you have forgotten in our long absence, and with me, as always, is Yanai. Hello, Yanai.
We are so back.
It's so Jover, man.
Is that what the kids are saying? Are they saying Jover or so Jover. Back?
Yeah. No, they're saying so back and then Jover. That's like the joke. Okay. Joe for Joe Biden, of course. Yes, Jover is kind of...
Well, Joe Biden is the end of history president, isn't he? Like
all the presidents are the end of history presidents, if you ask Fukuyama. That guy, man. Has anyone fallen lower than that guy? I saw him doing some sort of like praise Ukrainian heroes kind of talk at some university or other. And I was like, what's happening with you, my guy? Like, I know what's happening. He's just coasting on tenure and success, right? Like, he doesn't give a shit.
Sure.
Cool.
There are some worse versions of people doing that, but
it's like the liberal catch, right? Like, he's not the worst person ever, but he makes you inordinately annoyed and pissed off.
Yes.
But you don't want to waste time because, I mean, he's not Jordan Peterson, right? Like, there are worse academical figures operating right now, but he's just so annoying, man.
Yes.
Yeah.
The very idea that, the idea of fascism has been defeated forever.
Yeah. Or the idea of liberalism will, you know, is safe from any other threats and will forever, you know, march on into glory.
And if there's any corruption that seeks to undermine liberalism, it must be burnt out. I'm setting up a segue.
Yeah, no, I could tell.
I'm doing a thing.
So speaking of burning out corruption, today we are going to do something that we promised before we completely disappeared. By the way, that's because I moved to the US. That was the whole thing. And also, Yanai is doing a PhD and a bunch of other stuff.
Yes. The little thing of that.
Yeah, exactly. Just an afterthought. We said that we would do an episode about 40K, Warhammer 40K. And I promised that I have like an idea for sort of a format that would make this episode a bit different from other episodes, because Warhammer 40K is not a work, right? It is a setting. And actually, one of the things that we'll claim on this episode is that it's a setting without real canon, with so many authors, game designers, role play game designers, artists, even musicians contributing to the lore of 40K that it's kind of spiraled out of control. And we're
thought, did you ever play like a round
the
of
miniatures?
The miniature game?
Yeah, I did. I played for some reason. I mean, not for some reason. We'll actually talk about it. 40K is very, very, very popular in the UK. Also fantasy, not just Warhammer. And that's because Games Workshop is based in the UK, but also because Warhammer is part of the historical moment of the popularity of sword and sorcery in the UK in the 70s and the 80s, where Michael Moorcock was operating, one of the main influences on 40K. I mean, the guy literally wrote about a future Britain that's ruled by like space marines with animal helmets for armor. But also,
like Conan the Barbarian, right?
Yeah, exactly. Conan the Barbarian, which is also very popular in the UK. But then also stuff like Dune and Tolkien and a bunch of other stuff. These influences are cited directly by Rick Priestley, which he is the creator of 40K. Like, if you want one person if you want to be arborescent about it and think about it as a tree and you want the root, then it's Rick Priestley with Brian Ansel and Richard Halliwell. These are the three
doing
people.
Doing a Deleuze.
I'm doing a Deleuze. I'm always doing a Deleuze. And they designed the fantasy miniature game, by the way, which preceded 40K. They released it in 1983, which is smack in the middle of the Eternal Champion, the popularity of Dune and of Tolkien and all this stuff. And also other things, by the way, like 2000 AD, the comic book setting sort of like magazine. It also includes Judge Dredd and stuff like that. So these are kind of like, this is kind of like the milieu to keep doing French stuff that informs 40K. If you don't know entirely what it is, It is a miniature war game where two or more players compete using miniatures on a field of battle. They have kind of like an oversight of the entire battle. And each miniature with the corresponding rules has certain abilities and traits and attributes and so on. And you try to either defeat the opposition, inflict a certain number of points of damage. When you kill a unit, it's worth a number of points. And then you can get to like a total where you are considered the victor. Or there's other formats like Capture the Flag, King of the Hill, and stuff like that. Now, most importantly to our needs, as the game became very, very popular, there were some, not spin-offs, but like additional divisions of Games Workshop, which is the company that runs Warhammer and Warhammer 40K. And one of them is the Black Library. The Black Library was founded in 1997 in the UK, and it became sort of, think about like the Star Wars Expanded Universe, except this was...
Yeah, I was going to say like an expanded brand...
Exactly. But this was like officially recognized and officially a division of Games Workshop. And they started building or writing and publishing art books, background books, graphic novels, and other stuff, including, most famously, the books by Dan Abnett, who contributed both to Warhammer Fantasy and to 40K, and is pretty much the originator of many of the tropes that we think about today and the aesthetics of the setting and so on. But since then, I mean, if I were to try to list all of the media that has been published for 40K, we would, or Warhammer in general, we would be here for hours. There are multiple role-playing games, board games, and video games. Like the value list of Games Workshop video games in Wikipedia has its own value, and you can scroll through it for like a good minute. Including strategy games, first-person shooters, even like sports games, because there's Blood Bowl, which is like the bloody version of football played in the fantasy setting. Novels is even worse. Just the Horus Heresy series of novels is, I'm not joking, 54 books. Again, they're by multiple authors, right? And they have like internal cycles and so on. And then you have the Siege of Terra, which is an additional 10. You have the Primarchs, which are is an additional like 15, and so on. And so like this keeps going. It's insane.
It's interesting. I think that hearing you describe that, Warhammer sounds kind of like just a different offshoot from wargaming, from D&D, which is also an offshoot from...
Of course. I mean,
from wargaming,
it happens at the same time, right? If you think about D&D second edition, right,
which is the one that actually took off, like
exactly the one that actually became the version of D&D, that is Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, as it was called back then. It was released. I mean, there was like arguments about when should be counted, but 1977 to 1979, which is 4 years before Warhammer. And of course, D&D also started as a miniature war game. So you are 100% correct that they're both from the same kind of movement.
Yeah, and both have exploded into their own, world of content with players. Interesting, like what both these sides kind of highlight.
For sure, 100%. So what do we want to do? Okay, I'll do like a lore intro in a second where we introduce like the main conceit of Warhammer 40K. But I don't then want to like focus on one work because we haven't read any. And to be honest, a lot of the books are bad. Some of them are very good from what I've heard. But a lot of them are, you know, they're pulpy tie-in novels. Lots of people really like them, which is fine for them. But instead, I want to do something else. The Warhammer 40K is very often cited as a big example of the impotence of satire. Right, because where Warhammer 40K tries to present a super fascist, imperialist, brutal, and theocratic version of humanity in space, a lot of people don't understand that it's supposed to be satire. And to be frank, a lot of the people working within the Warhammer 40K setting don't think it's satire and unironically think these things are good.
Yes, I was going to say that it's not just a failure of satire, it's a way in which satirizing fascism can fail. And it's interesting to think about why exactly that is. Fascism has a weird like immunity of like being made grotesque because it's a self-aggrandizing kind of ideology, and so like just doing it more and doing it like more extremely, often, which is often like the satirical move, right? Like somehow like fails to satirize fascism. And just looking at a couple of trailers for games, like in preparation of this episode, I think at least like computer games play the fascist stuff like pretty straightforward. There's like a feeling that you are the fascists, like, and
100%.
that that's good, kinda.
I think in general, the more you move away from the more subtle and fleshed out lore of the game itself, and you move into secondary franchises and secondary media, the more you lose the, but this is bad actually, because if you go and dig through the actual history of the Imperium of Man, which is the main faction at the center of the setting, you will find fucked up stuff like friendly fire and genocide and like setting up people for failure intentionally, the suffering of billions of humans and so on. But then you play the games, some of the games at least, and that's almost completely gone. A good example is Battlestar Gothica, where you play like people on ships, and it's like a tactics game in space, and the ships are also supposed to be like mega fucked up. Like, for example, you sacrifice people to get better speed for your engines, right? But it's entirely missing from the game, or at least not very emphasized. So instead of doing that, we are going to say that if, you know, everything is up for grabs, the text is, you know, we were postmodern, right? So the text is completely up for interpretation and there is no authentic version of the text, but the text exists between the meeting with the medium and the reader. We can just read it differently, right? And we're not even making stuff up. We are just trying to highlight the other voices inside of 40K. Because one of the most interesting things about Warhammer in general, and it was truer for fantasy when it was starting out, it used to be a lot more radical than it was. The original fantasy Warhammer included many things, by the way, influenced by Moorcock, who is an anarchist and a leftist in general and has progressive views, things like anti-colonialism, where the Slann, which are like lizard people who live on a continent which is very clearly South America, are depicted as superior to the colonizers, and they often defeat the colonizers. There's also a lot of, today we see it as limited, but like strong female protagonist feminism, where women play an equal role to men. We are aware of the problematics of that today and the sexualization of like women in these kinds of stories, but still, for the 80s, it was a pretty radical game. And if you want to read more about that, because we're not going to go into that much. I'm going to try to find this article which opened my eyes. When Warhammer was radical, the egalitarian origins of the fantasy battle game by Zhu Baji. I think that's how you pronounce their name. I apologize if not. It's a really good article, by the way, posted on a blog that I really like called We Are the Mutants. It's a very good blog if you're looking for stuff like us, like thoughts about sci-fi from an anarchist leftist perspective. This is a really good article, which we'll try to remember to link in the comments. And it goes way into more details about like the radical origins of Warhammer. But we can still find these gems inside of the Warhammer setting, and that's what we'll do. We'll introduce the Imperium of Man, and then we will try to go not to every faction, but faction by faction of the Xenos, the aliens, which are supposedly the bad guys of the setting, but are actually a mirror for everything bad about the Imperium of Man. They each, or so I will claim, they each represent a different aspect of why the Imperium of Man is actually bad and take it to its extremes with the purpose, of course, of criticizing current fascism and theocracy and capitalism and imperialism and so on. Actually, not so much capitalism, more imperialism than capitalism, which is interesting. Yeah.
So I would kind of characterize what we're interested in doing as a kind of move in the a kind of move that repeats itself in discussions about co-optation. So co-optation is the worry about, you know, any kind of device of left-wing activism being eaten up by the thing that it's trying to criticize, often mentioned in the context of like language or organizations. And then the critique is often, you know, you take this thing that was supposed to promote kind of leftist messages, and it's been co-opted. So it can serve to promote, you know, bad right-wing messages, right? And so one kind of move in this discourse is to say, well, almost every form of language can be co-opted. You have nowadays like postmodern conservatism. You have, you know, people reading Foucault and doing doing like fascist stuff with it. And just wait, in 20 years you'll have critical race theory, like people on the right. How would that look? I don't exactly know, but it will happen. And so the idea is, in some places we can just do a discourse fight, basically. So I understand the position, we both understand, I think, the position of saying, you know, just making fun of people who treat Warhammer 40K as a fascist text and saying you don't get the satire. But that's, I mean, that move has been made, right? What we're trying to contribute is just doing some discourse fights in this arena. And like you correctly described, this arena is being contributed to by so many authors, so many artists working in so many different ways, and also by a huge community, right? So it's an ongoing fight. So this is, I think, us kind of throwing our...
Yeah, jumping in.
Yeah.
And I think it's also, it could be a format for how to do it with other things, right? I think not conceding cultural ground is something that's very close to my heart because I listen to metal. And the instinct of a lot of people there is to say, oh, black metal is like, all of them are fascist and we should stop listening to it. And like, no, it's the opposite. Like, we should go in and reclaim it, which is, to be fair, one of the major movements in black metal in the last 5 years. But that's not what this episode is about, although we could have an episode about that as well. Okay, so at the center of Warhammer 40K is the Imperium of Man. The Imperium of Man is a massive, sprawling political unit that is all centered around the Emperor. You might have heard, even if you've never thought about or talked about 40K ever, you might have heard the term the God Emperor, which I think Frank Herbert popularized in the fourth novel of the Dune books, but today is mostly associated with Donald Trump. His fans took that from 40K. The God Emperor of Mankind is
pictures
this...
of him in this huge armor.
Yeah, exactly. So the God Emperor of Mankind is the most controversial figure in the controversial Imperium of Man. He today in 40K, 40,000 years into the future, he is half alive, half dead, strapped to the throne of Terra, which is basically a huge life support machine. And supposedly, that's what the propaganda says, uses his substantial psychic powers to help the ships of man navigate the warp. The warp is kind of like a parallel reality or another layer of reality through which you can instantaneously travel, but it is the realm of the Chaos Gods, which are the main baddie of the setting, and without the Emperor's light, you would be forever lost in the warp. Why he's injured, read the Horus Heresy if you want. You can just read the Wiki about it. I'm not going to go into it. The Empire is maintained by three different major factions. I mean, it's maintained by 100,000 different factions, but the main ones are the Ecclesiarchy, that is the Church, what are they called? I can't remember the fucking Latin names. The Astrato Militarium or whatever, the military, and the Inquisition. The Ecclesiarchy are in charge of, you know, keeping the vast majority of humanity believing in the cult of the Emperor. The Militarum is the Militarum, right? They keep expanding the borders of the Empire, Astra Militarum, sorry. And the Inquisition roots out corruption from inside the ranks of humanity. Now, I'm prefacing this. I'm not the world's biggest 40K expert, right? Like, it's probably not true that the Astra Militarum is its own faction. Yeah, I don't care. Those are the main branches. And hovering above those branches, the most famous and wildly celebrated and fantasized about faction, the Space Marines. Space Marines are all genetic clones of the Emperor to a certain extent, although they have divergence and different chapters and abilities and so on. And they are like 9 foot tall superhumans who can, you know, three of them can take on an entire fleet of bad guys and so on. And they are also very, 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 very fascist. They are brutal, uncaring, cold, calculating, or the opposite, like completely gone to lust and rage and greed and destruction and so on. And it's, the joke is always hearing that the Space Marines are arriving. On one hand, you'll win the battle, but if you're not a Space Marine, you'll probably die, right? Because they don't give a shit about you, and they will bomb their own ranks just to secure victory and so on. Which brings me to the most important thing about the Imperium of Man. There are hundreds of billions of people, hundreds of billions, and tens of billions are born and die each year. So the Imperium does not give a shit about anyone. No one matters. Like, even the grandest Inquisitor, there are 5 of those. Right? There are 10 of those, because the Imperium is vastless. You should think about the end of the Roman Empire. This is obviously what the Imperium of Man is trying to model. So there's corruption at home, but the borders are still very much, you know, far away from Rome. The military is incredibly powerful, but cannot be effectively mobilized because threats are everywhere, and everything is just a day before collapse. Like, think about Rome just before the Visigoths invade. Everything is hanging
back. I think, like, the values, the vibe, the mood, we have extractionism, we have toxic masculinity, we have you know, a militarized culture. Like, most of the things that will be discussed about are expansion and power and defeating enemies, fighting corruption. Maybe you wanna get there next.
Yeah. So the next stop is the Chaos Gods. So that's the Imperium of Man. Like, we could do a 5-hour deep dive into the Imperium of Man, but that's pretty much the vibe that we're going for here. So keep that in mind as we're talking. Now, the easiest way to talk about the enemies of the Imperium and how they each represent a sin of humanity or a sin of authoritarianism and fascism is the Chaos Gods. These are the original baddies.
Wait, you refer to the premise you are planning, but I don't think you described the premise you are planning to employ.
Oh, didn't I? Whatever, I'll do it again. So we're going to go faction by faction of the enemies of mankind. And I'm going to make the point for each one of them that they represent a flaw, a fault, a sin in not just humanity, but specifically the model of humanity that the Imperium of Man is a simulation of, right? Authoritarianism, theocratic rule, extractionism, imperialism, and so on. The idea is that the Imperium of Man is blind. It's in the law, right? Like, it can't see itself because it's so massive. And it can't, it's the, are we the baddies joke, right? It can't see that what's the difference between you and others when you're willing to, like, sacrifice everyone and destroy everything just to say that you're successful. And each faction is going to show us a different aspect. Of course, because the Imperium of Man is a simulation of actual existing political regimes, it also aims to criticize the actual regimes, right? And actual existing humanity and our flaws and our sins and so on. That's the premise.
Yeah. And I think a couple of things to say about, or I add one thing about the setting, and then we can start with the Chaos Gods. So something interesting is that this setting is relatively placed in what's called deep time, which means we are in a future that is so far from our present that there has been a kind of disconnect in the human idea of progress, because we are still very technological, like humanity is technological, but it is not developing its own technology. It is relying on technology that it can no longer understand. And I think this is, as a kind of grounding metaphor, this is an interesting way to think about fascism, because this is a kind of common thing in the places where fascism takes root, that you have this kind of industrialized society that is very productive, often designed by people who have more care for actual thriving of society than fascists do. And then you have a kind of turn towards a hierarchical organization of society, but that often cannot sustain itself. And so we get to this deep time situation where it's, you know, the empire can conquer, but it can't produce. It's not reproducing its technological advancements. It's just conquering areas. And I don't remember, but I think from that we get that it's not so critical to the to their ideas. Why are they expanding? Like, what's the point?
So the point is that the emperor has decreed it, right? The emperor decreed that only man can survive, right? That's part of the zealotry and the fanaticism of the emperor. His whole thing is that humans are the superior race or species, and they must control the entire universe because all of the other races are tainted by many things, whether it's the chaos gods or there's like a proto race that creates them. Again, I'm sure that like a super fan will come into our comments. Actually, I encourage you to do so, and tell us why that's wrong, and like why the Imperium of Man actually does what it does. But it's kind of a fact that the Imperium of Man has been crusading ever since it has existed. In fact, one could say that the Imperium of Man only exists for the Crusades.
Yeah, classic fascism. I mean,
yeah, exactly. It expands for expansion's sake. I think, by the way, that some of the like the mystery about that question is at the core of some of the role playing games, right? Like you want to find out why this is happening, and there's like a twist, but it's not ever covered in the lore. I don't think so. Okay. So the Chaos Gods. The Chaos Gods are the oldest and most pernicious enemy of humanity. That is, they literally, so the Chaos Gods exist in the warp outside of space and outside of time. So for them, Warhammer 40K and Warhammer Fantasy happens at the same time, which is funny because the games use that as an excuse to do crossovers. Like some of the bad guys in Fantasy. Yeah, some of the bad guys in Fantasy have 40K technology that they like bring back in time. But the point is, ever since the sins have existed, each Chaos God existed as well. The Chaos Gods, there are four of them. The oldest one is Khorne, the God of Rage, the Blood God. The most famous one, because you have the meme, Skulls for the Skull Throne, Blood for the Blood God. That's what his followers say, and it's become kind of like a meme. After him, there is Nurgle, sometimes known as Papa Nurgle, the Plague Lord, the Chaos God of Disease and Pestilence. And then there is, I think it's Nurgle and then Tzeentch, if I remember correctly. Tzeentch is the Chaos God of Time and of Prophecy and like introspection and sorcerer's power. And then the youngest god is Slaanesh, the god of desire, lust, sexual like decadence, and so on. The youngest and upstart Chaos God, who was the recently born, by the way, not from the Empire, which is, I think, an interesting point which we might discuss.
The fan service.
Yeah, the fan service, God. Exactly. So the easiest one is Khorne, right? There was this like really So one of the latest iterations of Warhammer in other media is Bolt Gun, which is what's called a boomer shooter. So think like in the style of old Doom and Quake and so on, set in the 40K universe. The main thing it had going for it is that they got, what's his face? Rahul Kohli, who played in Midnight Mass and in other places, to do all the voice lines for the Space Marine. He's a huge 40K fan. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, what you do in this game is like you do what Space Marines do. You drop on a planet and you proceed to like kill everything. And it works good for a boomer shooter, right? Because you're running around these big arenas and you just destroy demons. But then I saw
I think that's the trailer I saw for like where you see Space Marines being bros and talking about, you know, kicking ass for the Empire.
Yeah. And what I saw was a comic book, which not a comic book, like an internet comics, which started me thinking about all this stuff, which was Slaanesh and Khorne in like the Chaos God break room. And Slaanesh, they're like looking at the Bolt Gun events from like a portal, and Slaanesh asks Khorne, "Are you sure he's not one of yours?" Like that he's a good Space Marine and not a Khorne Space Marine. And I was like, yeah, that's the point. The point is like, what is the difference between a Khorne Space Marine? So Space Marines can be corrupted by a Chaos God and turn into traitors. Many chapters have become traitors over the course of history, ever since the Horus Heresy. And they become like the Space Marines, but now they're Khorne Space Marines, right? They get their images corrupted. Like, what's the difference? If you look from a distance and they have no insignia, there is no way to tell the difference between them. They're both murderous, and they're gladly murderous. Space Marines don't like kill and then bemoan their fate for having to kill. They love killing. They rejoice in killing. One Space Marine says he does it for the Emperor and for the glory of mankind, whatever that means. And one says he does it for the Chaos God and blood for the blood god. But they're functionally the same. And the first and easiest and main critique that the Chaos Gods levy against the Imperium of Man is like, you are violence. Like, you are the main exporter of war. If we had to point to one faction in the universe that has the most weapons, the biggest weapons, and uses them the most willingly, that's you. Like, you keep saying that you are under threat and people are trying to kill you and Xenos are trying to destroy you and they have unimaginable weapons, but like, you have Exterminatus, like you nuke entire planets from orbit just because they are corrupted.
So this reminds me of a kind of turn I had in the way I think about a lot of fantasy, in which in a lot of fantasy, the way that evil gets kind of cashed out is that there are good people, there are bad people, and then like the good people will proceed to like enact incredible violence against the bad people, and all of that will just like fall in the like good person category, just because they like they initiate from a side of good. Now, that I mean, when you read Lord of the Rings and stuff, like there's no part of Lord of the Rings that talks about like Sauron being like a bad ruler or whatever, right? It's all very metaphysical. He is evil, but like it's not, I guess in the Silmarillion there's some like bad stuff that he does, but like barely, right?
Yeah.
And okay, so it's all kind of silly when it's in a fantasy game, but I think as a critique of like Forever War, which, you know, was, I mean, I don't know if we're posted. I don't know if there will be like another Iraq or Afghanistan, but like, it, you know, writing this game in 83, and you know, what would they be thinking about, like Korea or Vietnam? And this idea of like the good old boys are coming into like yet another country and they're gonna set things right, and kind of saying like, you know, these soldiers of order, they're not really doing any ordering.
Yeah, it's like what it's saying is the teenage joke of what does it go? Fighting for peace is like fucking for virginity.
Ah, yeah, that was on all our bathroom stalls.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the idea. Like, you set out for peace and peaceful existence, and but you end up generating the war that you claim to avoid. And of course, it goes back, you know, directly to, you know, for example, the 14 words of Nazis, right? What is it? We must secure a future for white children, blah, blah, blah. Like, who's coming after your white children except for the people that you aggravate by being white supremacists and by being imperialists? Like, you know, if we want to get super spicy, like, there wouldn't be an Osama bin Laden if there weren't American imperialism that, like, invaded half the planet. So the war machine creates the war which it intends. Nurgle, I think, is way more subtle and way more interesting. There's like the first level, which is pretty obvious, where Nurgle is gluttony, right? He's like obese, like obesity as a disease. And he represents, you know, the insatiable hunger of the empire for more resources and more control and so on. But underlying that is the critique of muscular fascism and like fascism of the body, which, interestingly enough, by the way, I don't know how many people know this, but there was like a faction of early Zionism, which was kind of like a fascism of the body. It was led by Max Nordau, who's like a very famous Zionist. He has like a street named after him in Tel Aviv. And he did a whole like Zionist PE program for boys to like give them the proper like strong bodies to work the land and all that shit.
Yeah, there was a lot of actually, interestingly, kind of a longing to be like the local what would they be called, like Arabs, like a desire to be like the muscular they call them falachs, like the like land workers, right? Who are like muscular from working the land, as opposed to the kind of academic reading people that came from wherever.
Yeah, and it also, of course, fed into anti-Semitic caricature of Jews as weak and feminine and so on. We could go on, like, read Edward Said, basically, right? Like, the femininity of the Oriental and so on. And Nurgle kind of, you know, makes a mockery of that by saying, I, too, like to change the body, right? I, too, like to take things to the extreme and see what can be done with biological systems. But of course, he more overtly twists them into mockeries of flesh and spreads disease and so on. But like, that's what the Emperor does as well. Like, space marines have, I don't remember what it's something ridiculous, like 6 lungs and 3 hearts, and they can jump buildings and do all that shit. And that stuff fucks them up. Like, in a lot of the lore, the reason space marines are the way they are is that they're constantly juiced up on this like genetic enhancement and all the tech that they have, that it completely fucks them up. Or if you go to the tech priests, right, which replace a lot of their body with technology and so on. And Nurgle is kind of like, when you're a fascist and you think about like the Golden One on YouTube, right? Like, he's a very famous fascist, like, and bodybuilding
is
in general.
Is he still around?
They've all kind of died off, right? Like, all these grifters. The grifting is in other places now. Yeah, so he's still around, though. I bet if I go to YouTube and I fuck up my algorithm completely by typing in the Golden One, I'll find the Golden One. Anyway, like, bodybuilders in general, and like the extremes that to which they go to, like, there's something unhealthy about massive vanity muscles and so on. I'm not coming after everyone. I'm sure there are very healthy bodybuilders. But when you take it to the massive extremes, then that's also unhealthy, right? Like, fitness to the point of injury and distortion of regular human function and so on.
I think there's some kind of problematizing between like the idea of control and the idea of excess, where the kind of fascist reserved kind of my body is a temple kind of vibe is like, again, when caught up in the fascist machine is pursuing this excess of expansion. But it's also like, so Horkheimer and Adorno have this concept where they say, you know, okay, for every human, what is the one resource that, you know, only you have access to? It's your body, right? Like, every other resource you're in a direct competition for. But your body is your own. And so within a kind of framework that seeks to rationalize the world, dominate the world, turn everything in the world into like subservient into something else, there's a kind of race where, you know, the first thing that everybody tries to subjugate is their own bodies. That's what's called the grindset, right? Like the idea of, you know, work really hard, you know, work long hours and, you know, never complain. This is you subjugating your own body. And the kind of immediate consequence of that, why are you subjugating your own body? It's to make it into a machine to subjugate something else. So I think what is nice about the kind of line you're drawing is that the kind of desire to of self is it abnegation, like to,
yeah,
to
objection
to prevent from yourself,
yeah,
becomes the desire to take over others and absorb into yourself.
Yeah, I very much agree with that. And I think Nurgle is one of the more interesting chaos gods because the criticism is just a bit more subtle. And then you have Tzeentch. Tzeentch is also very interesting. He's my favorite chaos god. He's the god of time.
Everybody has a favorite.
Yeah, of course. And his thing is that he is like the foolish wise man. He's like the desire of the Imperium of Man to know everything and to be in control of everything, because he famously, like his one of his most powerful servants is Kairos Fateweaver, and he's like this bird-like creature with two heads, and one head sees the past and one head sees the future, but they can't see the present. And because of that, they always make perfect plans. That's always the joke about Tzeentch. He makes perfect plans, but because he can't see the present, there's always one fault in them. Of course, also based on free will and the choice of individuals, which he can't predict and so on. But he's so lost in his books, in his intellectualism, in his plans, that he loses track of what is actually happening, which is exactly the Emperor, because the Emperor is a fucking idiot. Like he was all-powerful and massive, but he did things like neglect so many of his children that they became traitors just because he didn't speak to them for like hundreds of years, or give them impossible to follow decrees, or just in general, like be so flippant towards the Empire. And it's all explained by the fact that he has this grand plan to execute, but he loses sight of the details. And the Empire in general, as we said, grinds millions, billions of people into dust just because of oversights, right?
So I think this is echoing for me the people who are the lore masters of the Empire, I think. And they're featured in this game that you recommended for me that has a name that is kind of like Latin word, like Ars Mechanicum or something like that.
Yeah. Mechanicus 40K.
Mechanicus 40K. And so it's the tech priest, right? And the tech priests have, interestingly, two extremely contradicting orders. One is to gather knowledge, right? They're in charge of like making the machines keep running. And the other is to burn like any anathema. But what is anathema? Anathema is just knowledge that they, you know, that doesn't fit into their own kind of schema. So you have these people whose charge it is to expand like imperial science, but also to destroy everything they don't already know. So it's this kind of like crazy, like obviously meant to fail intellectual pursuit, which, you know, appears in a lot of post-colonial criticisms of Western epistemology, where, you know, you have this idea of a science that is completely unbiased, that is in the words of no one, and it is part of this mechanism that is trying to take control over like the entire world. And it's very convenient for a science that is trying to be the science of the entire world to be the science of that is supposedly in the words of no one. But in the process of doing that, it destroys a lot of local knowledges because they cannot be mapped on. And because those knowledges are, you know, not fitting with, whatever is the flavor of the day. In the beginning, it was Christianity. So it was It was important because it was Christian. And then, you know, the flavor of the day was a kind of deism or atheism. And then the, you know, the others were too superstitious, right? Like they believed in God, so they must be wrong. Like, never mind that all of our scientific knowledge is based on hundreds and hundreds of years of people who believe in God. Yeah. You know, these quote unquote savages believe in God. We must destroy their knowledge. Yeah. So I think tech priests like really embody this contradiction and this thing that you say about like looking at the past, looking at the future, but never looking at like reality as it is.
For sure. And I think it's also like a criticism of techno capital, right? Like this idea of capitalism that if we just invest enough money in technology, it will solve all of our problems, right? All I need, like the tech priest, is just to replace one more body part. The tech priests are interesting also because they are technically heretics. Like they worship the Omnissiah and they say that it's the emperor, but it's not the emperor. And a lot of lore like hints towards the fact that they're worshiping some sort of dark precursor god, which I think is really interesting. Like techno capital is almost flying out of control of the Imperium of Man and is its own faction with its own ideas. And there's always clashes between the tech priests and the inquisitors. I think there's also some of it in Mechanicus, right? Like they hint towards the fact that they're like rogue agents. And it's really interesting because it's that exact same, like if only the iPhone was bigger or smaller or whatever the flavor is for iPhones right now. And if only we like had better vaccines, that there wouldn't be plagues, right? But that's not how that works. It's always looking towards the future and the past and the fact that we're improving and this is where we're going, but it's never looking at the price, the bottom line that is actually being paid by the people as these technologies are rolling out. And then the last god is Slaanesh. And Slaanesh is also very interesting because technically Slaanesh is birthed by the, like this big orgy that the Eldar do. The Eldar are like the last race to fall from grace before the Imperium of Man. They were like these super technological, they're elves basically, right? Super technologically advanced and kind of like ethereal sort of race, which collapsed in this massive orgy ritual to one of their gods because Slaanesh was born. When Slaanesh was born out of their lust and decadence and so on, the explosion kind of like destroyed all of the leadership of the Eldar and also poisoned the species. So on the face of it, it has nothing to do with the Imperium of Man, but it actually has everything to do with them because it is a statement about the repressed mores and social control and sexual control of fascism, right? Like if you think about, lots of people talk about the Hugo Boss uniform, right, for the Nazis, and how the perfect Aryan man was this handsome, blue-eyed, very hot, right? Like they imagine them as hot, but there was no sex in Nazi propaganda. Everything was repressed. And you weren't supposed to be promiscuous as like a Nazi officer. You were supposed to be like a good Aryan raising a family. And there was no talk, of course, it was also the spirit of the times about like women and their pleasure and so on. Like everything was very desexualized. Same for Mussolini. Like, you know, there's always the joke of what's so conservative about thousands of men in tight leather clothing marching around squares and admiring each other's muscles and pose. But beyond the joke, like there is a lot of repressed sexual energies in fascism. You see it, of course, with their obsessions, right? Like, and the fact that they always tell on each other, on themselves. So the right has groomers, the right has pedophiles, the right has rapists and sexual abuse and assault. Not to say that no leftists have ever done any of those acts, but like the movement which excuses those things is the right, not the left.
We recently had a sad example of Russell Brand, someone who, you know, at some point was, you know, an investigation of his allegations of, you know, I think things that amount up to rape. You know, so he was notified years before, and then, you know, unbeknownst to us, like starts to slide, you know, directly into the right. And now you have within the right a lot of people defending him, being like, you know, he's being
prosecuted.
Like the QAnon thing, like if they're aiming at you, you're above the target.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of excusing for that. And, you know, there's so much discussion of how, like, this sexual repression is in itself kind of fetishized.
Yeah.
You know, it has these symbols. A lot of people talking about these influence, like trad wife influencers who are like,
yeah,
you know, conventionally attractive women who kind of cosplay being wives or something.
Yeah, I mean, not to go too deep into the kink and fetish direction, but like that's a very good example, because what do they draw from that fantasy? Those women are always supposedly conservatively dressed, but they're not dressed as women really were like in the 50s. They're dressed as the promiscuous versions of that dress. And it's all about, and that's completely fine by itself, you know, the pleasure of delaying gratification, right? Like seeing that woman makes them into a fetish that you can imagine conquering, owning, controlling, and then finally indulging in. Right.
Yeah. And if you could be straightforward and kind of, you know, explore your kinks in a straightforward way, you know, nobody gets harmed. That's fine.
Yeah, of course. But when it involves like the subjectification of women, that's a problem. So Slaanesh is all of that, right? Like Slaanesh is exactly the, you know, the assassin geisha trope, right? Like the, I use sexual desire to blind my target, and then I get close and destroy them, or reveling in pain, right? Like sadism and masochism and so on. And it's kind of like the perfect mirror image of the empire, because the empire has none of that. Like suffering for the empire is like Christian suffering. It's like the cat of nine tails or the hell shirt, right? Where you suffer supposedly to flay yourself and to make yourself pure, but you enjoy it. Right, and a lot of Slaanesh is like tempting inquisitors, right? Like inquisitors are very much this Christ-like martyr figures, which suffer endlessly for knowledge and for the betterment of the empire. But they are the most susceptible to corruption by all the chaos gods, but also by Slaanesh, by saying, "Come on, we both know why you're suffering, right? Like you like it, you get a kick out of it. Has nothing to do with the emperor or purity and so on." So. Those are the Chaos Gods. I'm not sure we're going to do all the factions, mindful of time, but we can and should, of course, keep going. And I think the other famous two factions, actually, that I want to maybe bungle up in one place is the Orcs and the Tyranids. Mm-hmm. The reason I'm putting both of them in the same bucket is both of their things, they're very wildly different, but both of their things is proliferation. Canonically, Orcs are mushrooms, sentient mushrooms, and they spread by accumulation and release. So when you get too many, so orcs are also powerful psychics, but they don't know that they're psychics because they're stupid, because they're orcs. But when they all gather in one place, something called a wa, and you should imagine that with more A's, I'm just not going to scream into my microphone, kind of happens. When they reach critical mass, their psychic energy makes them stronger and begins this migration where they just arrive in a system and completely overtake it. Many, many orcs die, but the orcs win, and then they proliferate again, and the war happens again, and so on, and they live their life for fighting and expansion and so on. And they also have this rickety kind of like technology where they bolt pieces of metal to things, and it works because they believe in it. Their psychic powers make their technology work, which is one of my favorite 40K tidbits. For example, when you paint something, what is it? When you paint it purple, when you paint something red, it makes it go faster. But because of orc psychic powers, it's real. Like when they see a red car, they're like, oh, this needs to go faster, so it goes faster, which is phenomenal. And then Tyranids are like a virus. Right? They're also biological, like purely biological entities, but instead of reaching critical mass, they're like insects. They're like the aliens from Alien, right? They arrive, they lay their eggs in huge swarms, consume everything, eat everything, and then are pushed by biological necessity, because all the resources are gone, to keep expanding. Mm-hmm. And both of these enemies highlight a different aspect of the Imperium of Man, which is its both its expansionism, but also its emphasis on natalism and both, right? The Imperium of Man, kind of like the Nazis and the fascists, have this idea of doing your duty by birthing more humans so those humans can go to the front lines. And because we're being assaulted by endless hordes of beasts, we need endless hordes of humans. Yeah. And if you're not doing that, you're not doing
social
your...
reproduction.
Exactly. And of course, both the orcs and the Tyranids are motivated by the same pressures, right? The same kind of like biological necessities, except they don't pretend to do otherwise. You need to understand, like, the Imperium of Man doesn't literally like flash propaganda to you that says, you will die, you are awful, we hate you. No, it says things like, you will sacrifice yourself for the good of the Empire, you will protect the Emperor's name, you will do your part, right? Whereas the Tyranids are insects. Now, they can't talk to each other, they have language, but they're a hive being, right? They're a swarm. And the orcs are like, yeah, we fight because we like to fight. Fighting is good. So it's kind of like takes the masks off the Imperium and saying, no, this is not about like purity and honor and duty or whatever. It's one, like we said with Korn, you like to fight. You love yourselves the most when you're fighting. And you're dedicated to a god which is the god emperor, who is a war god. And you should just embrace that. And two, the Tyranids, you're just creatures, you're animals. You reproduce because you are biologically engineered to reproduce, and there is nothing greater about your expansion. It's just the animal need to proliferate.
Yeah, and so I want to, well, you know, we should always, you know, make a mental note whenever like a race is a race of stupid people, like just to note the eugenic urge there.
Yeah, actually have a very problematic kind of like origin to them.
Yeah, but just kind of moving straight past that.
Yeah.
So I think what you said about the orcs is really interesting in relation to how fascism has a way of making you dumb, and I want to resist the kind of image that, you know, that the quote unquote dumb fascist is like, you know, it's because everybody who supports, you know, conservatives are like Bible Belt, you know, working class, you know, quote unquote stupid people. First of all, that doesn't bear out, like, statistically. A lot of the people that you think are kind of like, you know, the salt of the earthers of the Republican Party, a lot of them are like, you know, the homeowners, actually. And when you look working class, it's a little bit more complex because you also have to look across racial lines. But also, I mean, being a worker, and it kind of depends on which time, does not mean that you have to be uneducated. You know, my grandparents were like working class, you know, in Argentina or whatever, they read Marx, they read Hegel, like they had those books in their library. And, you know, it's not that important to read Marx or Hegel. It's fine if you haven't. But, you know, they had the capacity to do that. Those books were meant for normal people to read them. Fascism makes you dumb in a different way, which is it floods your head with ideology.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to think about the orcs as people who have strong psychic powers that they don't understand, which is exactly how ideology works. Ideology is extremely powerful. It's just, you know, absolute nonsense that sends you in weird directions. It's not weak. It's powerful. And so, I mean, the thing that reminded me with the red making the car go fast is something that I always find fascinating. And that is, this is a very specific like pull. So there's a phenomena of making fun of soldiers who are like, you know, queer presenting, making TikTok videos.
Yeah.
This is a thing that happens on social media. Someone will share like, you know, a cute soldier like dancing on a tank or something for a TikTok video and be like, oh, the US Army is doomed because this is its soldiers. And the funny, so obviously, like, this is like a whole theory of masculinity, But it's also just like making you extremely dumb about how the world works. You know, the U.S. Army is very powerful because it has big tanks and like drones and like so many arms. And, you know, the soldiers there that need to be able to like whatever, carry a thing can carry a thing. That's not the problem with the U.S. military. It's not going to collapse because of like having gay people, nor are gay people like, you know, weaker or whatever.
Yeah.
It's absolute nonsense. It doesn't like connect two things. But when you start thinking like a fascist, you can think like absolutely insane things, like the army might be weaker if there are like some gay soldiers around.
Or Donald Trump is a secret agent taking down the elite.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Great, great man. Like this idea that Trump, you know, even if Trump like does have some knowledge of like whatever, like a super conspiracy, whatever, whatever, like what kind of like superpower does Trump have? Like, he's just a guy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, even if you thought he was smarter than he seemed, like, how smart could he be? He's just a guy. If he knows something, he could just tell people and, like, maybe something will be done about it. There's not, like, more, like, to talk about, right? So I think it's interesting, like, to think about these orcs and, like, haha, they're so silly. Like, they have an idea, like, red car, go fast, where, like, you know, within our militaries, we have people who think, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell was like in the 90s. Like this game is like precedes Don't Ask, Don't Tell. We have people who think that if the soldiers like, you know, are men that fuck men, then the military will be weaker, which is, you know, more insane. Like I would prefer people who think that dying car red make car go fast.
Yeah. So I think, oh God, I was just reading a Reddit of ranking the factions in morality, and someone said that all other factions except for the Tau and the Imperium are evil, and like, ooh, the Imperium is okay. Evil, man. Anyway, so in the last group, and again we could have made this longer and talked about every single faction, but the last group are kind of like the races which represent what it looks like when the goals of man are achieved. Like if the Imperium was actually real about the goals that it wanted to achieve of like prosperity to humanity and technological utopianism and all that stuff, what it might actually look like. And then it shows how even their goals, even if you take them at face value and you assume that they will actually go and do them, are fucked up. And of course, by comparison, fascism, like even if you said yes, they actually want to protect the children, they actually want to, you know, make sure that people have jobs and that you know, the trains run on time and all that bullshit, even if that was true and possible, then the things would be fucked up. And into this bucket I put the Eldar, the Necrons, and the Tau. So the Eldar are as close as you can get, except for the Tau, to a good faction. They're the fallen civilization that birthed Slaanesh, and now they are trying to warn other factions about the dangers of the warp, right? Because they did like this huge warp ritual and they birthed a Chaos God. So their thing is like, children, you know not what you play with. Like elves, right? They're older,
They're elves.
Yeah, they're elves, yeah. And the elves, by the way, in the fantasy setting kind of like play the same part. They're like, we remember what things are and what's really important, and you're bickering amongst yourselves. Same thing here. But the thing is, they're not really able to do any good because they are tainted by the doom. Actually, thinking about it, it's literally just the doom of the Noldor from Tolkien, right? Because of who they were and their fall from grace and everything that happened with Slaanesh, they are doomed to fail. All of their works will be poisoned by their melancholy, solitude, individualism, and they kind of have that like bad immortality vibes, right? Like they're very long lived, and that's a bad thing because, you know, they grow thin and wear out their purpose and so on. And like, I'm not even talking about the Dark Elves. The Dark Elves are just pure evil, but the actual Dark Eldar, whatever, the actual Eldar are the they're the end result of all the heroism of the Empire, right? All these space marines, all these primarchs and inquisitors and so on. Like this idea that if you gathered enough power as an individual and you were just righteous enough, then you would be able to correct everything by virtue of your righteousness is exactly what the Eldar are an example against. There's few of them. They're individuals, very powerful sorcerers, and they have a lot of technology, but they're falling apart. Their entire culture is collapsing. They no longer have the ability to reproduce effectively or talk to each other, understand each other, or band together. They move in these small packs that slowly die off because they no longer have a foothold on a community, on a species, on a civilization. Instead, they were focused on power and enlightenment and so on, like the heroes of the Imperium. So that's the Eldar. And then you have the Necrons. Necrons are weird. One of my favorite factions. A friend, mutual friend of ours, Noyan, his favorite faction is the Necrons. And these are like robotic beings created by the Precursors, who also created the Eldar and a few other races. They are completely technological. And their thing
like
is...
Vibes, right? Like the reanimated corpses or something?
Yeah, so that's more from fantasy where you had the Tomb Kings. The Necrons are like the 40k Tomb Kings. But yeah, they're like eternal. They're immortal and they've slept for millennia in giant pyramids, right? They're very clearly like pharaohs, Egyptian, ancient Egyptian kind of influenced. And their thing is like the Eldar, like you're all bickering and there are dark gods out there worse than the Chaos Gods that are going to consume everything and we need to make sure that they stay asleep and stuff like that. And the weakness of the flesh, and they made themselves into these robots so they could stay on par with the entities that would destroy reality. Again, we're not going to go into all the lore of like the Precursor Wars and all that shit, but that's basically what it is. And they're like the end goal of technological advancement, right? They are the most advanced, the most technologically powerful, completely replaced everything about the flesh with technology. And as a result, they're even worse than the tech priests, right? They sleep for millennia just to wake, fight against whatever forces need fighting, and then they go back to sleep. They enjoy nothing. They create nothing. They innovate nothing. All they do is resurrect old technology and old wars and old people, entities, and fight their eternal fight, even though why are they fighting? Like if they win, they will still like be unable to taste and feel and enjoy and anything because they've given it all for the struggle.
Yeah, the idea that, you know, you can subjugate the entire world into rational production, but like at the end of that won't like create a quantum of joy.
Yeah.
If you start from the idea that everything needs to be, I don't remember where I read this first, like this idea that basically under capitalism, like enjoying things, people keep talking about it as like the rest that they need from work.
Yeah.
And that was really transformative for me. And I like immediately stopped doing that and like, you know, told people around me to stop doing that. Like, you know, I remember this discussion where I was like, I work so I can play games. I don't play games so I could work. Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and also, like, you optimize every single piece of your life to be rich or hustle or be successful or whatever, all for one day retiring and supposedly enjoying all of that when you're old. And, like, you'll enjoy it less.
Yeah, and it's not just that, like, I mean, old people can still enjoy things, but it's, like,
yeah,
the process of rationalizing your entire life kills the part of you that can experience joy.
Yeah, that's what I meant. It's not because you're old. It's because you put yourself through this ringing machine, right? Like you rebuilt yourself into a machine that is now unable to rest. I suffer from it myself, like being unable to rest. I'm much better at it than I used to be, but it's still difficult for me because all of my life is engineered towards optimization and being effective. And when the time comes to let go, which is supposedly the time that I worked for, to have that relief, I am unable to stop, right? Just like the Necrons are unable to stop. And then lastly, the Tau, and it's fine that we left them for last because so has Games Workshop. And it's a joke like that they're not getting any books and any lore and nobody cares about them. The Tau Empire are humans. The only humans outside of the Imperium of Man. They also have Xenos but they also have a lot of humans. They're founded by Xenos, the Ethereals, who are again like created by the precursors, but they have the highest concentration of humans outside of the Empire. And their thing is that they're communists. They have a philosophy called the greater good. That's why they're called Tao, by the way. It has nothing to do with like the Tao as in the philosophy, the Eastern philosophy. And they're all about sacrificing the individual for the success of the collective and the real success, like bettering the people who are inside the Tao. They are not discriminatory, like multiple Xeno species are inside the Tao. And they're the closest that the setting has to a good faction, except they're not. Because
so this is about how fascism and communism are actually the same.
So kind of, it's kind of cringe, but they do something else. What they do is, so the thing about the Tau is that they turn you into drones, right? They don't turn everybody into drones, but everybody that is inside of the Tau network, I guess you call it, can be overridden by the collective, right? And can be made into this kind of like mindless servant and into this drone, which yeah, is a cringe UK sort of leftist critique of communism where everybody's the same and nobody has any freedom and all that bullshit. But in
the Chinese, Eden, they have a social network that is giving people social
scores. Yeah, we don't do that at all in the West. Yeah, and also all the bullshit of like, oh, they're so coordinated and they're so together and all that fucking racist bullshit. But we're doing our discourse, right? And in our discourse, it is another criticism, like the other two races in this bucket, of even the fact that you emphasize the common good so much, like you're liars, you're not actually interested in the common good. But even if you were, the fact that you're willing to like destroy every single individual just to arrive at this supposed common good is fucked up. Like, let's say I was a fascist. Let's say I agreed with you about every one of your values. The fact that you are willing to take people and throw them into the meat grinder just to achieve those goals is fucked up in and of itself, regardless of what goal you are trying to achieve. Right? The systems that you build should be able to allow for individual flourishing alongside the common good, which is what communism does. But we will forget the poor British leftists for their mistakes.
Should do, let's say. I mean, I wanna hold out a spot for like every form of governance can be corrupted and misused.
Yeah, of course. And I think, by the way, that if you want to make a criticism of, I don't want to get into the discussion, but like Soviet Russia or Stalinist Russia or whatever. Yes, there was. My main criticism of the USSR is that there was an untoward emphasis on the collective good, which oftentimes caused individual suffering. Right? Like, these are facts. Not all the people that Stalinism killed were bad. A lot of them were. And I'm not saying they deserved death penalty, which is another problem, but some of them were just people that Stalin didn't like, or that wrote a poem that was, you know, supposedly hurting the revolution. And they got killed for absolutely no fucking reason, because the common good was an excuse for everything. And like, you can be cynical and say they didn't actually care about the common good and so on, but it kind of doesn't jive with the evidence. And also it's kind of meaningless as a historical criticism, because this is what you learn in your history BA, like take people at face value. If they lived like 100 years before you, if they say that they cared about, you know, changing the world and spreading Sovietism to everyone so that everyone will flourish, most of them probably believe that. But that's exactly
the point. In the absence of any evidence.
Exactly. So, and that's exactly the criticism of the Tao. Like, I might agree with your end goal, but that's fucked up. That's fucked up. Like, you saying dissident poets should be killed because they interrupt the march towards the common good is bad. That shouldn't happen. And it's not just poets, right? Like, if someone disagrees with me politically and they don't organize into, you know, people can say about the Kronstadt and Trotsky and all those people, they were like organizing to destroy the state and the revolution and to roll back all of the achievements that we had. And even if that's true or not, doesn't matter, because others clearly weren't. They just disagreed with the state on things. They weren't organizing. I mean,
one of capitalism's strongest powers is like its ability to contain and
subvert.
You know, subvert, but also like handle the existence of distance. So, you know, we can publish our podcast that is very critical of capitalism and capitalist systems, and they are robust enough to eat that, right? So I think any leftist project should also think about being robust enough for like handling the fact that a communist state will have anti-communists.
Yeah, exactly. And like the choice to eradicate them is not a choice. It's unacceptable. And by the way, I think that's what authoritarian communists said without a derogatory implication have to learn from anarchists, right? Which is, how do you keep cohesion in a group without stamping out disagreement?
Yeah.
Okay. So we've explored most of the main factions. We actually did pretty well. Like all the other things that we didn't talk about, all the other factions are pretty minuscule. Like we didn't talk about mutation and chaos cults and gene stealers and all that shit. But these are like, for the most part, branches off of the main trunks that we mentioned here. I want to say something like, in defense of 40K, I really like 40K. And I also really like fantasy, Warhammer Fantasy. And I think there's a few reasons for that. Some of it is just because, you know, mecha cool, right? Like plasma gun cool and shit like that. I think there are a lot of cool authors and designers and individuals working in the 40K and fantasy spaces. But I also think there is a lot to be said for pulp and exaggeration and the power that it leaves you to do things like what we just did, right? Like think about things differently and interrogate ideas and have fun, right? Which is also very important. I still think that a lot of 40K is awesome and badass and really well written. But I also think that as time goes by and Games Workshop becomes more and more successful and richer and larger, they move more and more towards decisions by committee, and they don't really care about, of course they don't, like subversion and critique and stuff like that. And things move towards the direction of, you know, this is cliche, but releasing new factions so you have more figurines to sell, right?
Yeah.
And I think standing around and waiting for them to change their ways is pointless, because they won't. That's not, what was the metaphor I once used? It's like asking the Pope to fuck. He's not going to fuck. He's the Pope, right?
But so they want the Pope to fuck.
You can want it as much as you want. It's just not going to happen. So like expecting Games Workshop to, I don't know, release anything subversive at this point is ridiculous. But luckily for us, we're postmodernists, right? So we can do whatever the fuck we want with text. And we can tell stories in 40K and fantasy settings that are leftist. Nothing is stopping us. Nothing. Yeah. You could say whatever you want. You could say that the Emperor of Man is actually Stalin. You can do that if you want. I don't know why you want to do that, but you can do it. You can tell Warhammer fantasy stories about compassion and loss and indigenous liberation and a million different things. And they have been, like, these stories have been told. And you can draw inspiration from them. So if you're listening to this and you are currently engaged with the setting, I'm inviting you to do weird shit to it and read weird things into it. One, and if you've never engaged with the setting because you think it's full of right-wing chuds that never shower and they're all like thinly veiled Nazis, you're 100% correct, but you don't have to...
You're not 100%.
No, you're correct that they exist, but you don't have to sit with them. You can sit with us. We're cool. We do shit like write stories about how space marines understand everything they lost and try to rip out their modifications, and how inquisitors are like actual baddies, and why US cultists should like resist them, and a bunch of other cool stuff. So I welcome you and I urge you to, you know, get started. It's really fun. It has a lot of cool shit in it, and it's kind of a shame to like leave it to all those people. And I hope this was a good final. Yeah, go on.
There's so two things to close. One is about this thing of kind of throwing our voice into the Warhammer discussion. In Naomi Klein's No Logo, she talks about how Disney started suing people for using like images from Disney in like art, basically.
Yeah.
And what she says is, listen, these companies flood our collective space with their brands, and we have a right of response. So we have the right to take these brands and take them in the directions that we want to see them and create art that subverts what they mean. So that's one. And that's kind of like, so if you like 40K, and which I do too, though I haven't done as much, but I have played multiple role-playing games in it, played multiple video games in it. Like I've done some 40K stuff. And so if you like 40K and you want to think about it as a subversive space, that is definitely something you can do, and you should feel like within your right to do it. And the second thing is just, like you said about it being awesome. Listen, I think that, I mean, it's good to ask ourselves, like, what is fun about fascism? It is sometimes fun.
Yeah.
It has appealing qualities, and we should be, you know, carefully, but we should be playing in that space. Like, that's something that games can give us, a kind of like experimentation there. And then we can make that into a critical space where we say, like, I mean, I don't know why I like so much the idea of like a big man with big armor, like killing a bunch of dudes, but I do. And that has implications for like what I emotionally feel. And there are other, like, by the way, franchises like that, like this, like 300, if you remember, that came out when we were teenagers. Like that's just a fascist movie about being fascist. And it's fun. It's fun to imagine yourself being like the fascist Spartan. And yeah, I think there is a beetle like crawling right next to me. regardless of that, I think that fun is something that we should kind of play with and, you know, contain our enjoyment of it in a game atmosphere, and then use that as a subversive thing, as asking, like, what is the fascist impulse? Like, why do I feel this?
Yeah, fully agree. Okay, so what else have you been enjoying since we last spoke?
Oh my.
Choose one.
Yeah, it's been a long time. I usually prepare for this. You start.
I'll start. I finished reading Simon Jimenez's The Vanished Builds, and it fucking blew my mind. It's like one of the best science fiction novels I've read in the last decade.
Wow.
Super good. Yes.
That's a lot for you.
Yeah, Simon Jimenez is a Filipino-American. He's queer, and he writes exceptional science fiction in the vein of Becky Chambers, Ursula Le Guin, and so on. So, like, think about compassion-based space opera. The conceit is that humanity has abandoned Earth and lives in a series of stations which use planets as, like, resource repositories. Interstellar travel is made possible by the pocket, which is kind of like the warp. But the thing there is that time passes differently. So you spend 4 months in the warp and, well, the pocket, and 15 years pass in real time. But somewhere out there might be people who can instantaneously travel. And there's like a search for them. And one of them is like the protagonist, and can he do it or can't he do it? And it's all about memory and family and loss and growing up and finding each other and so on. And it's just beautifully written. And, you know, I always talk about how one of my main problems with most stories today is that they can't face subtlety and complexity and like leaving threads open. And this completely and utterly does and sits with the complexity of things. Phenomenal, phenomenal book. I really recommend that people out there read it.
Repeat the name once more.
Simon Jimenez, The Vanished Birds.
The Vanished Birds. So I think recently the thing I have anarchist thoughts about Baldur's Gate 3, but we might do an episode on it one day. So
yeah.
No, so recently I've been following a podcast and reading Book of the New Sun.
Mm-hmm.
And I am conflicted about it. It's not my favorite piece, but I will say that it presents a world that is that has these complexities that you discuss.
Yeah.
And I think gives you a kind of skewed perspective. It's kind of doing the thing that we were doing throughout this episode of showing you the world through the perspective of someone that is, you know, in a kind of like masculine way, you know, quote unquote awesome, but also like a bad person who does bad things and mm-hmm. like thinks bad thoughts about the world. And that's your kind of view into it, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I could talk about and have talked about the Book of the New Sun, in length. But I didn't know you were reading it. That's interesting. It's a journey for sure. Yeah. And one of the works, I know it's annoying, but like one of the works that just gets better once you complete it, because a lot falls into place. But I get what you're saying. It's a conflictory book. It's not a book that I recommend very commonly. But if you're willing to dedicate yourself to it, I think it's one of the most rewarding ones out there. Okay, that's it. Thank you for listening. I mean, we're back. I don't know what that means. We'll figure out.
The boys are back in town.
I don't know. We'll figure out what that means. I haven't prepared, like, what is the next thing that we're going to talk about. Maybe I'll get my PC back soon. Maybe we can do Baldur's Gate. And yeah, we'll be seeing you. Thank you for listening.
The book.
Yeah, and don't forget anarchysf.com. I have more free time now. Maybe I'll release 2.0. I visited 2.0 this week and I was like, man, this is almost done. you just need to finish it. So maybe I'll actually do that. But for now, it's still there. Our good friend and like the guy who started this, Ben Beck, is still updating it, which is kind of crazy and awesome. So go and check that out. And we will see you for the next episode. Goodbye.
Blood for the blood god.
Indeed.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.